Bob Boylan, have I told you lately how much I love Sturgill Simpson?
No, but this is the right time to do that.
Yeah, his new record out today on April 15th, A Sailor's Guide to Earth. He is just such a heavy thinker, and I love that about him. He's a seeker. He's a searcher. He's always looking for higher meaning and purpose in his life and through his music. You know that last record he did that we were all floored by, Metamodern Sounds and Country Music? I thought it took a lot of chances with the country music traditions and forms. You know, he had a lot of the same sounds, but his narratives weren't anything like, you know, My Truck or My Dog or My Woman.
And that's why I listened to that record.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Me too. And there were these metaphysical, existential meditations. But on this new record, he takes even more chances. Oh,
in
I
fact,
think.
When I heard this new record, I thought of something more akin to, I'm going to play this, right? Now, this isn't Sturgill Simpson, but it reminded me of the opening to A Sailor's Guide to Earth.
This is Pink Floyd's One of These Days from Metal, yes. Which I would have never thought, but you know, on this new record from Sturgill Simpson, he definitely gets into some psychedelic sounds and heavy guitars, synths, some very trippy synth sounds.
We haven't played you the opening track to Sturgill's new record yet. I know we're going to do that, and we're going to talk to Sturgill Simpson, but there was one more thing I wanted to play for you. It's a cut called Last Date by Floyd Kramer, not related to Pink Floyd, but Floyd Kramer, the Floyds here. Maybe he's got a thing for Floyds, I don't know. And so when you listen to what we're about to do, which is we're going to play music from A Sailor's Guide to Earth, and we talked to Sturgill Simpson, when you listen to that first cut that we're just about to play.
From Sturgill's record.
Think of those two things I just played. The song from Metal, the Pink Floyd, and this from Floyd Kramer. That's all.
And we're going to talk about how these two worlds meet on what is otherwise a country record.
Yeah. Well, let me play this then. From Sturgill Simpson's brand new record, A Sailor's Guide to Earth, a letter to his son, and we'll talk all about that. It's called Welcome to Earth, Pollywog, in parentheses. And then Sturgill will join us and we'll talk about the making of this record.
To admit, when before the piano kicked in and I hit play, I had to pull my phone back out and look to make sure I'd hit the right record when I first heard this.
And that's an ultimate compliment, right? I mean, that is what what you want.
That's high praise. I'll take that.
Hello, my son, welcome to Earth. May not be my last, but you'll always be my first.
I feel like I'm finally hearing me, because you know a lot of elements of music that for whatever reason just didn't get incorporated or implemented into the first two albums. So with this one, I had total I don't want to say control. Nobody likes that word, but it's what it was.
Well, you produced it. You were the producer of this record fully. Is that
more of a? That's a. I don't even know.
Okay. Explain that. Because what did it mean to you? What does it mean?
I just didn't want to collaborate with anyone. I didn't want to compromise. And the record was so personal, I just didn't see how anybody else could have been like, well, what if we did this here? Because in a lot of ways, I formulated the sound of it in my head on the road long before we ever went into a studio. And it was sort of a I had the lyrics and the idea before I had the songs. Like, the songs were actually sequenced before many of them were written in terms of the narrative of the album. So it was self-indulgent and probably overproduced, but all my favorite records ever made were overproduced. So it's a word that whenever I hear somebody use that word, I instantly think, I can't talk to this person about music.
Well, sometimes I think that means like they've thrown everything in the kitchen sink and into the mix, and too many bells
sure.
and whistles.
So, I mean, Sergeant Pepper had literally had bells and whistles and kitchen,
you know, and chickens.
Yeah. Yeah. Dark Side of the Moon, What's Going On? Like, a lot of the albums that directly influenced this one for me were gorgeously and marvelously overproduced.
I'm going to play one that I think people would think of as overproduced. It's not yours.
Yeah. Yeah, I ripped this. That's to it.
The gull's at the top. Let's listen a little Otis for a minute.
I'll be sitting when the evening comes.
We just listen to Otis the whole time.
Watching the ships roll in. And then I watch them roll away again. Yeah. I'm sitting on the dock of the bay. Watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm just sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home in Georgia.
So, you're how old when you first heard a song like this?
This song, I can tell you exactly how old I was. I was probably one. And then
wow.
two, and then three, and then four. My grandmother, as people can read if they pick up your book. yeah, this is one of the first songs I ever remember hearing. My grandmother had one of those wooden sort of furniture pieces where you'd flip the top up, and there was the record player down in it with the big tube stereo and the speakers, and it sounded amazing. I don't know what I would pay to have that thing in my house right now.
But we got to get one for him, Robin.
Oh, yeah.
She had a bunch of old 45 soul records, and she would clean the house and play, put them in there and just let them go through one by one. But this one was on repeat a lot. And to me, it was like magic, you know, with the seagulls and the thematic elements and everything. I'd heard music, obviously, but that was the first time I'd ever heard this. You know, it was almost like a Peter and the Wolf element.
Right.
To it, you know.
Filmic.
Yeah, filmic.
Yeah.
Very widescreen music,
right,
if you will.
And he got his ideas, Otis Redding did, from Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
I mean,
he was completely inspired by the Beatles to do that. Never lived to hear it.
Yeah, never heard it.
Never
That's
lived
so sad.
To hear it, which is sad
he's,
and amazing.
He's definitely my... I get a lot of comparisons and hyperbole, but Otis, I think, for me, is probably my favorite singer. Him and Marvin Gaye, probably.
And Robin and I were talking about this on our train ride here, which is that this is a record for you that you kind of think of as a country record.
Whatever. My record or
no,
Otis?
Otis.
Otis is definitely a country
yeah.
singer.
So what makes a song a country song or a country record? Is it more of a point of view than a sound?
I have no idea. At this point in my life and my career, I honestly have no idea.
I begin to wonder that if
I think any good music is soul music.
That's good.
There's bad music and there's soul music. And if it's if it comes from the soul, it's probably going to be good. I can hear soul and well-done electronic music,
uh-huh.
you know.
Mm.
Because when I listen to your new record, I think, is it fair to call this a country record? Is this a country record? I don't know.
I think it depends on what side of the political fence you sit on in Nashville, whether or not it gets called a country record. My last record, I'm pretty sure, was a country record, and that was called Americana. Even though it literally had the words country music in the title. So I don't know how anything works at this point. I just sort of stopped thinking about it.
The beautiful thing about this record is, for anybody who's had a newborn child, and you said you outlined this, was it at the moment of conception or child's birth that you thought about this as a record?
It was actually more of a cathartic reckoning, I guess, sort of. I didn't know if I even wanted to do this anymore.
Do this as in make music.
Well, my son was born about a month after the last album came out. And then when things started taking off, he was like, literally this thing I've obsessed and loved my entire life and thought about and always wanted coincided with this other thing that you somehow love even more. Mm-hmm. You know, and having to balance the two and not being there and missing out on so much. I was feeling a lot of guilt and homesickness and transitional acclimation, for lack of a better term. I'm 30, almost 38 years old, so it's tough when all of a sudden gargantuan amounts of smoke start getting blown. You know what I mean? If you're 21 and copacetic and really into the attention and the narcissistic elements of this career, it can be right. Great. But
we're not talking about smoke. We're talking about praise.
The proverbial smoke.
Proverbial praise.
But I feel like I'm maybe too normalized to ever take myself seriously in the role of entertainer, as it were. But I'm very grateful for the fact that I get to make art for a living. Mm-hmm. So I always try to put that at the forefront of what this opportunity is in terms of how I view it as an opportunity.
And can we just lay out there the idea of, you conceive this record, how did you conceive it? So for people who haven't heard yet, A Sailor's Guide to Earth.
Sorry.
Let's just talk about how this lays out.
Well, I'm out on the road, and the tour kept getting longer and longer and longer, and I kept watching him grow up more and more in pictures, and I was just kind of like, well, there'd been so much made of the last album, you know, and then once I signed with Atlantic, I just sort of figured, well, this may be, any album you make might be the last album you get to make, and I figured if nothing else, you know, my wife, primarily, and my family, and wanting to have something in my life I could feel proud of and that they could feel proud of and that it wasn't a disappointment, I thought, well, no matter what, I feel like I need to say thank you, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to do something really special for my kid that he'd always have. And maybe that is, I don't know if it's selfish or selfless, but I figured also, if, you know, your first major label debut, might as well self-produce it. And, you know, I knew at some point in my life wanted to produce records, probably more so than I want to go out and entertain. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of now or never.
I kind of thought of it as, politicians, when they run, they get elected, and if they get reelected, then they see that as like a mandate. They can now do whatever they want.
Now you can do your job.
Now you can do whatever you want. Yeah.
Get that second term, you can actually.
Yeah, so I thought when I heard this, I thought, well, I guess he got reelected from after that last record, and now he's doing what he wants.
Well, it ain't out yet. We'll see how it goes. But no, it was just a really freeing realization. It was just like, okay, I'm going to go make this really pure and beautiful thing for my son and incorporate all these elements of music that I loved outside of and other than country or bluegrass, which is all I've really had a chance to represent up until now. And then the idea of the letter, I think, is what you're asking about, the concept behind the my paternal grandfather, when he was in the Army in World War II, he was over in South Pacific, and he thought he was going to die, and he wrote a letter to my grandmother and their newborn son, thinking he wasn't going to come home. And this letter set my father's sister was a big antique collector, and somehow she had and had held on to this letter forever. Nobody in the family ever read it. Nobody would read the letter, and it sat on a nightstand, almost on display in a guest room in her house. So about 10 years ago, after she passed away, my father and I were at her house for the funeral. And I never got the chance to know my grandfather very well. He was very stoic.
His name was?
Aura. He's very shut off, sort of between war trauma and then his wife dying very young from cancer. He just wasn't emotionally available a lot, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And then kind of a hard guy to get to know. And years later, after he was dead, and then once she'd passed, I was at her house, and I just decided, I'm going to read this letter, you know. And I probably learned more about him in those few pages than I ever could have sitting in a room with him, you know. And I just thought, and for whatever reason, I remember going down the road in the bus one day and thinking, like, what if I could just write a letter to my kid telling him, you know, exactly who his dad was, or like everything I'm going through right now at this point in my life.
That's right.
Without comparing it to being overseas at war, which I'm sure people will mistakenly make that comparison.
Still, it's a snapshot.
It's just a snapshot.
He won't ever know you as...
Not right now.
That's
other
right.
than in pictures and what he reads on the internet, which is all mostly misconceived. So
so there you are. You're putting it out there.
Yeah.
You want to play a song that might be good for... let's pick a song that you would love him to hear when he's a teen.
All Around You.
Every day when it seems like the whole world is against you. Don't be afraid, life is unkind. You can let go of the pain if you choose to. As time slips away, skies fall apart. Feeling too long. Hey, you.
So what's the message for your son about love?
Love.
Yeah, all around.
Just thinking a lot of points in my life where younger and you're, you know, angry or confused or just misplaced or lost, and you have this tendency to sort of not be aware of how much of it really is around you and even shut it out. So just kind of a reminder.
Something that you wish somebody had played for you or said for you when you were younger.
I mean, I probably heard it and blocked it out anyway, but yeah. You know, yeah, just not letting the weight win.
Who was doing all the, who did all the arrangements and everything for you? You got a lot of horn parts.
Well, we did the songs were tracked and composed and arranged, and then I hired a guy I have a lot of respect for, a very classy gentleman named Jefferson Steinberg, who did a lot of stuff for Motown and others, and he came in and did all the string arrangements and all of the horn arrangements except for two songs, which the Dap Kings and myself did. We just kind of scattered them out in the studio.
But and the Dap Kings, for those who don't know, are a band.
Brooklyn horn section, yeah. Here in town. Yeah, I wanted some really dirty city street-level brass. Nashville's great for a lot of things, but horns and strings is not one of them, so
too
to speak.
Sweet?
I wanted to kind of get flavors of the records that I loved, which was a lot of Detroit and Motown and Stax sounds. And you hear it, I don't want to sound like a snob or anything, but I guess I'm kind of a musical snob. But in a lot of ways today, I hear a lot of people just incorrectly using horns as pads or layering as opposed to almost like a second drummer or emphasizing things for emotional lift. And I just wanted to sort of try to, you know, incorporate that.
Would you say less lyrical, more percussive? Is that kind of it? Or
well, you know, a lot of times I hear them, it's really bright and shiny.
Gotcha.
And for me, like, my favorite records where there was always brass for the stuff where it almost feels like it's pulling down. It's like a heavy, dirty funk to it, you know. They can just, like, taste the green patina on the saxophone. So and those guys are sort of known for being dogmatic about a certain time period and what they're trying to achieve and the way they play together. And I knew I didn't want a bunch of random guys coming in just looking at charts. I wanted a section that knows how to push and pull against each other, and they've played and breathed this thing together.
Can you think of some artists that you love the horns in that, I mean, that you,
yeah,
you mentioned
a lot of Merle
labels.
Haggard records.
Merle Haggard.
Yeah. The Elvis, especially the Stax stuff. Mm-hmm. Gosh, man, I mean, where do you start?
Yeah,
Marvin Gaye, right. Any of them, like whoever the sax player was that threaded through all those albums, he kind of overplayed, and it's just gorgeous. But those are some gut references.
So in your head,
Van Morrison used to love.
Oh yeah, putting this together, making what you had in your head, did you get surprised along the way and wind up in places you didn't expect? And if we can play
an example
of that, like,
yeah, absolutely.
For some people, it's a matter of you hear it in your head, and it's a matter of just making it happen, and that's that. It's
well, if you have a sound in your head, that's the best thing about a town like Nashville or even New York. So much, there's all these amazing players, so you just kind of get the right guys. I look at it as sort of like a giant toolbox. And, you know, you can flip the lid up, like a Floyd Kramer and a Pig Robbins. Those guys were both amazing, and both of them could probably play the perfect thing the first time, mm-hmm. but they both played two completely different perfect things. So it's kind of what you're after. I spend a lot of time beating up my road band.
Meaning pushing them in directions.
Yeah, I'm very, very, I can probably be considered a taskmaster. I don't know, but nobody's quit. So, and I'm fortunate because they're all incredibly brilliantly gifted young guys and players, but it's like, you know, you get all this raw talent and having the ability to sort of arrange it on a chessboard. Mm-hmm. And then they'll, if the surprises come from anywhere, it's those guys, because they'll come out with things that maybe I didn't anticipate or expect. And it's, like I said, you know, perfect.
Yeah, that's the brilliance of collaboration.
That's the fun of it, you know.
So is there something that I could play here where you imagined a sound and came up, and something came up that was greater than, surprised you, or still thrills you to hear?
In Bloom.
In Bloom.
David Ferguson, the engineer, had a heavy hand input as well. I mean, the guy's worked with everybody. So
this is In Bloom. This is the song by Nirvana.
Send kids for food. Where the changes move, spring is here. Reproductive plan. He's a one who likes all our pretty songs and likes to sing along and likes to shoot his gun. You don't know what it means. You don't know what it means to love someone.
And you chose this Nirvana cover because, A, you were probably ripe when this came out, would be my guess.
Personally speaking, those records had a huge impact on my life.
Mm-hmm.
I was about 12 or 13, 7th or 8th grade, I think. And parents had just divorced, so I was like, you know, the latchkey kid from the broken home. So I felt like these records were for me, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of emotionally captured a lot of things I wasn't able to grasp or articulate or comprehend within my own head and heart at the time. And then looking back, it came to a point in the narrative of the record when I was working on it where I was trying to figure out a way, how am I going to embody those years in a young boy's life where you're sort of just aimlessly going through it all, the post-pubescent angst, and, you know, you're running around literally shooting your gun.
Were you?
Yeah.
Next.
My mother's listening. Okay. So my wife actually said, yeah, she had the idea. I was like, you know, because obviously this was 20 years ago for me. I'm not in that headspace anymore. So I was trying to figure out how to occupy that again. And she said, well, you know, what were you listening to when you were 13 years old? Like Nirvana. Like everybody else, you know. And so I was like, wow, okay. So immediately, without even bringing up the record, I just started going down in my head of that, never mind, that was the bomb that dropped and changed everything, of all the songs and like which one lent itself lyrically the best to what I was trying to capture and describe. And even though I know that's not what Kurt wrote the song about.
He sort of wrote it about fans that came late to the party, no?
People say that. A lot of people say he wrote it about his best friend Dylan, who knows, you know, except nobody knows but Kurt. I thought, one, the lyrics also in a different way lent themselves talking about spring is here again, reproductive glands,
he
likes to shoot our gun, right. And don't know what it means to love someone, you know. I was like, well, that could be, there's so many ways you could take that. And I screwed up the last line of the chorus because I didn't bother to look the lyrics up. It's just the way I always heard the song. And I always thought, one of the reasons I loved Nirvana so much as a kid was that growing up on a lot of country music and bluegrass music that my grandparents listened to, I remember reading some interviews when I was a kid and just obsessed with the band, where Kurt had said that how much he loved a lot of country and western music and guys like Merle Haggard.
Hmm.
And I always thought that was really cool, you know. So that, I guess that's been the most interesting part for me is, you know, hearing some of the negative feedback from people like, oh, Kurt would have hated this because, like, everybody knows what Kurt thinks, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I screwed the words up and had to write a letter to the family and the attorneys, like, to get permission to keep it on the record, or else we would have had to re-record the whole thing.
Wow. In Bloom, a country song?
I would strongly consider that version a country song. Country-politan, maybe. But.
Yeah. Because when I listen to Nevermind, which I absolutely love that record, but to me it was so cathartic and angry, and I mean it captured every frustration that I'd ever had up until that moment in my life. And I feel like with this version, it's so languid; it strips a lot of that out. But you were getting it to the core with the words, what you were hearing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also, I mean, the guy could write a hook like nobody, man. It's undeniable. He had this knack and gift for songcraft, and people get hung up on the sonic template, the noise, or the ambiguous lyrics. But I mean, for me, it was always just undeniably powerful music.
Yeah,
and just not just him, you know, the other guys in the band too. You could tell they really believed in what they were doing. And it's not for everybody, I get that, but I love him. I wish he was here, so I could say thank you. You know.
Yeah. I have a 4-year-old son, and Nirvana is one of the bands that I play for him, and he will ask me for In Bloom. He'll ask if I can play that song for him. Do you play Nirvana for your son? What, he must be a
I play all kinds of music at home. A lot of that directly influenced he and I watching Disney movies. That's kind of where the strings came from. Seeing his reaction to a lot of different musical styles when he was one and a half, and just so raw how they, you know, can be completely distracted with some blocks and something will come out of a speaker and it's like they just turn on a dime. So I thought that would be neat.
Did you become more sensitive when you had a kid? I mean, you're already a sensitive guy.
I'm a pretty sensitive guy.
Yeah, but I
think I became more empathetic to my wife, mm-hmm. more aware of her needs and feelings than maybe I was before. Mm-hmm. And I think it, you have to be more sensitive. There's this helpless, pure little joyous organism running around in your house now. So it's like, if you can't be in a better mood after that, you probably should go talk to somebody, honestly.
Aren't your emotions, though, haven't you found as being a dad, your emotions are so much more on the surface and so much rawer, your nerves,
yes,
than before?
Yes. I mean, they were pretty, I was kind of wore it on my sleeve anyway, but the emotions are much different now.
I would cry after my son was born, cry at any movie that had anything where a child was about to be hurt or harmed or in danger.
I can't
stop watching them completely.
I had a good buddy in the Navy when I was younger. I don't want to say his name. It's been years since. If I saw him yesterday, it'd be like but he married a girl while we were in Japan, and they had a baby, and about 2 days after the child was born, they had to take it off of life support. And he asked me and our chief to be there. And standing in that hospital room and watching that 2-day-old baby die in front of me, it had, like, I can't even begin to explain what a profound effect that had. It sort of darkened my view on the world for a good stretch, to be quite honest with you. And I was always one of those people that said, I don't ever want to have children, because I just couldn't imagine going through the pain that I witnessed them experiencing, you know. It's just this ocean of sorrow in this industrial military hospital room. It's just kind of like, but you know, I experienced a very different side of that, and I'm very glad I did that.
I wonder what your son at 13 will.
He'll probably be in a lot of driving. Yeah, probably. If it's anything like me, he'll probably be in a lot of trouble. And ignoring everything I just like put down on this wax for him. You know.
But it everything worked out for you, right? I mean, you did a lot of searching. I'll call it searching.
That's a good word for it. It's all subjective.
in your searching. Youth. But no matter what you may, if you wanted to have a do-over with anything, at the end of the day, it still led you to where you are right now, right?
Yeah, no, I don't regret. That's actually not true. I don't regret any. The only thing I regret, my one regret, would be missing my grandfather's funeral. Due to maybe, what am I trying to say? Life kind of got on top of me for a second, and I wasn't in the best position to come home and be in front of my family. So I had some things I'll always regret that. But other than that, I don't regret anything that I stepped out on the ledge, so to speak, to get a better view of.
That's a good way of putting it.
I think I read all the wrong books way too young, and that might have, you get this idealized, romanticized view of what life experience means.
Well, like what? Oh, you mean metaphorically? Read all the wrong books. Yeah.
Very, you know, all the wrong influences, wrong parties, wrong friends, wrong people. These things that, you know, but it seems like the wrong things when you are always more interesting, or seem to be anyway.
And I think with your kids, you want to map out this road for them, right? And everything's going to work out perfectly.
Boring
for them.
Is great.
but you know that they're going to take the path that they want to take. You know.
That's the thing. My parents, I mean, they couldn't have been any better to me. Like, I was never short on love but, you know, despite my mother or whoever doing the absolute best that she could and trying to make me this good human being, you still make your own choices, your own decisions. You can't say, oh, because this went wrong in my life, that's why this happened, that's why I'm the way I am. No, we all have the accountability, I think, is a very good word to use.
And what's happened to you happening in your 30s is better than it having happened in your 20s.
Oh, if this had happened 10,
meaning,
10
meaning or, your success.
Yeah, it wouldn't have happened. I would have self-destructed. I would have screwed it up. I would have offended more people than I probably do already now. it just wouldn't have happened. Yeah. And if it had have happened, it wouldn't have been very good for me, I don't think. So I wouldn't have had anything to say, honestly, at that point in my life. Mm. And maybe I don't now.
You do. Right.
I mean, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We thank you for it. Let's go out on a song. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you, man. Thank you.
What should we go on? What would be a good one to go out on? Sailor's Guide to Earth.
It's called on my record, man. Okay. Breakers Roar, I think, is my favorite song on the record. I remember that being the one that I really, because I sang it in a different way I'd ever sang on an album before, because when I was writing the song, I would sing it to my son, like putting him to sleep at night, so I'd have to sing really low. And I was like, that's cool, man. It gives this whole other intimate underlying feeling.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Sturgill Simpson, we're in New York City. His album, A Sailor's Guide to Earth, is out on April the 15th.
Woo! Woo!
Thank you.
About time, man.
Fair PR Music. I'm here with Robin Hilton. It's All Songs Considered.
Keep pulling me farther from shore. Thoughts turn to a love so kind, just keep me losing my mind. So enticing, deep dark sea. It's so easy drowning. Oh, and everything's not what it seems. This life is but a dream. Shattered illusions that hold your spirit down. Open up your heart when you find love all around. Breathing and moving are healing. Soothing away all the pain in life, holding you down. From the inside, so it seems, Oh, I'm telling you, it's all a dream. 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 It's all a dream.